You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
A key component of what we did is we embraced something called, what we developed called the Domestic Violence Investigational Guide. It was borrowed from a similar initiative in Alberta where they used it more as a check sheet, but, and I'll talk more about it, this guide became the structure of intake of how information would be obtained from victims. And it becomes pretty critical when you see the elements that were involved in it, because again, it causes a shifting of focus that never was that never happened in police investigation to this point. So the focus was on the structuring systemic response. A key component was reaching what we termed a mutual expectations agreement. And in essence, what this was a promise. So this was an agreement that the police would do certain things, that they could expect a certain level of investigative, a thorough investigation, and Crown agreed that we as a police could expect a certain amount of accountability. They would be answerable to us, and they wouldn't make arbitrary decisions, and we would work collaboratively, we'd work together. It was a very, very key component. And there's best practices both from the investigators and prosecution. So we said, based on the best information we know, we understand here's excellence in an investigation, here's excellence in prosecution, and we're committed to doing that. So just some of the things from the police structural elements. The Domestic Violence Investigational Guide, which I'll explain further, was the intake form of all the investigations. It was a standard of expectations. We would do automatically 911 recordings. So every time someone called for call for service, it was recorded, it was burned onto a drive, and a transcript was made. From a legal perspective, sometimes we'd have a scared victim that didn't want to proceed. We'd already have her statement locked down. And it wasn't done for a coercive manner, but it was really, the whole concept was to envelope the victim with support to say, this is not all, you don't bear this burden alone. There's multiple things that will end up making it not your sole responsibility to proceed on this or not. Photographs, simple things. We find often our investigators would take, say, well, the person had no visible signs of bruising. Someone said they were hit. We take pictures of any redness the first time, and we'd arrange for 3 days later to revisit, because we all know what happens when you bump ourselves, right? 3 days later, you've got a bruise half the size of, like a size of a football on your thigh. So extremely compelling evidence for court. So it was adding as much corroborative evidence as we possibly could. So this is just kind of more kind of conceptually what we're doing. Jocelyn likes this phrase on the bottom. Though leaving is the best response, it is to violence. It is in trying to leave that most women get killed. And that's certainly something that I end up reinforcing with our investigators, that I say, if there is one time in your entire career where you can show investigative excellence, this is the time. Like, this is not the time to end up saying you're going to do a part job. This is probably the most important thing you possibly ever can do. And education also helps frame the context of the things that were the structure that we put in place. So now I'll go into the Domestic Violence Investigational Guide. So the guide, really through, you can talk about the Be Safer Risk Assessment Tools, SARA, ODERA tools, and I've talked to Drs. Hart and Kropp, who have worked on Be Safer. A lot of the risk factors are very similar. You know, you could take people in a room, and we could actually write down what are the risk factors in domestic violence, and most of you would hit most of them. So what we ended up doing is the intake of our investigator. So as an investigator would speak to a victim, they would say, tell me everything, start from the beginning. They would learn the events that happened. Then they would go into this guided risk-centered questionnaire. Every question deals with risk issues. And it just starts with the suspect history, criminal violence, previous domestic violence, court orders, alcohol, drugs, employment, instability, mental illness, suicidal ideation. All the things that might elicit information about how this person might be scared. Weapons was front and center as well. Now, one of the most interesting things, now I'll switch hats into the academic guide. Victims have a very unique way of dealing with when you ask them about violence. If they say, I'm scared something bad's going to happen. You had better listen, because that means that they've broken through all the excuses, the minimization, all the stuff that causes them to say, you know, it's not that bad. You know, the guy makes me shower with him before he goes to work, and you know, I have to wear a leash in the house. Like all the things that they kind of, you know, that you hear from as an outsider's perspective, and you say, that's unreal. Like, how could that ever happen to you? But on the flip side, they oftentimes will severely minimize, and they'll explain things away. But the interesting thing we found through the Domestic Violence Investigational Guide, it's like, I'm sure all of you have experienced where you say, I need to talk out my problem. By focusing the intake interview and all these risk issues, what we found happening is victims were often starting to engage in the notion about what their very real risk was. Because it's like the words are going out, and these things that they've sort of been thinking about, they realize how dangerous their circumstance actually is. And a key point is it actually was facilitating their engagement in safety planning, because that's ultimately we want to make sure that they're safe through this process. And then relationship history as well. Now, one of the things we did, this is sort of the preliminary order of how we attended to the items. We were at a conference, Jocelyn and I, and we had someone that was a counselor, and one of the things Jocelyn was saying, it would sure help if I had the relationship at the beginning of the Crown Report. And he said, you know, from an intake perspective for counseling, oftentimes it's best to deal with the relationship up front. And then as we talked it through, we realized, and he said, most often that's the most pressing thing a victim may want to speak about, the relationship concerns. And so we changed that. We said, well, if that's what is going to, like, what's going to happen to my children? Like, how often will the person is saying, will I tell the police, will I not? It depends what's going to happen to my kids. And if we're not dealing with her kids, she may never disclose what's happened. So we changed that. So we said, okay, well, let's focus. It's about the victim. It's not about us as a police. You know, put it in a context that makes it easiest to get the information. So we changed that. I think one of the things that we found is it increased significantly the amount of files and disclosures that came in within our agency. And I'll give you a perfect example of something which I don't believe it would have ever happened. One of our investigators attended a call, which it was just on a watch report, overnight report, and it said, attended a domestic a verbal dispute, applied Domestic Violence Investigational Guide, determined a series of historical assaults that have never been reported, as a result, suspect arrested, held for court. Like, that never would have happened. Like, it's opening up the lens that it's not about here, it's about the history that's happened. And this guide was exceptional in eliciting those things that a victim wouldn't ever know, because really, if you're talking to a police officer, like, I don't know how many of you talk to police normally, but really, what do you know about police? You watch American television, that's a police officer. You don't know the rules, you don't understand, and most people that are interviewed, they're waiting for the cues from the police officer. Like, we have to educate people as to how we're going to respond, and it's about them and eliciting information. So what we found through this process, where initially Joss and I were more focused on us working together, we drew in police-based and community-based victim services, and we have such an excellent partnership in our community. I just can't say enough. They're just exceptional people. So focused on supporting victims. Community corrections became a key partner too, because what we're finding is if anyone was released, we had an automatic reporting condition. They had to report to the bail supervisor. The bail supervisor had to call the victim. Ministry of Children and Family was there supportive, not to yank children away, but how could they end up supporting? And what we're finding is each one of these service providers, when we're firing all cylinders, everyone kept going to the victim and saying, how can I help you? How can I support you? So it wasn't the victim that got the card from the police officer and said, well, what the hell is going on? I'm confused. You'd get multiple contacts, including Crown Counsel. One of the criteria for Crown Counsel was early contact with the victim. And to me, from Jocelyn and I talking this through, that seemed to be one of the most key things, because this was someone that had significant power within the criminal justice system. And even though it's really a, I know sometimes it's is difficult for Crown when I say this, but it really caused Crown to do a paradigm shift. In other words, they have a role of prosecution, but they can also have a very critical role in victim support. Because the idea is if you can do this and it's like enveloping the victim, you have somebody that feels actually quite safe and somebody that says, geez, you're actually caring for me. Now, interestingly, when I talked to Jocelyn, well, how are we going to measure success? Because when I was dealing with my master's thesis and I did KGB statements, recantation was a huge issue. It's a huge issue right across the board. Every intervention says victims recant. So Jocelyn and I went into this thinking that's what we're trying to achieve, drop recanting victims, because that is the victim's only lever of control. Because the system trundles off on its own agenda, and the victim may have all sorts of other different needs, and when the victim sees that it's not meeting her needs, or she's very scared, or she doesn't know what else to do, or it's too many decisions, it's like pulling the chute, I quit. Our notion was if it's safety focus and we're not reliant on the victim herself, we end up doing a thorough investigation with talking with the children, talking with neighbors, doing the history. And actually, one of the basic things, and I've got quite a history in serious crime as a interviewer, talk to the suspect. Like it is probably one of the most simple interviews to do, because generally when we apprehend a suspect that maybe had a couple drinks, what happens when we have something to drink? You start blabbing. Like you might say all of a sudden your boss isn't really that smart, right? And typically someone might be quite emotional. So you're less inhibited and you're emotional. Are you more inclined to talk? Probably. And if you actually sympathize with a certain person's circumstance, saying, geez, I could see how you might be upset about something. Next thing you know, the person ends up saying, well, yeah, she deserved to get hit because she wouldn't let me watch the Super Bowl. You know, all the idiocy that people use to justify violence. But the point of it is, it becomes critical corroborative evidence for police. And again, takes a weight off the victim to bear that responsibility alone. So anecdotally, one of the things we found is that victims felt consistently supported. We found the quality of the investigations that were being done. Oh, and I should add that domestic violence investigational guide, different than a check sheet, we compelled the investigator that those 19 risk factors had to populate the narrative to Crown. So you see how that's different? Like, they would have to talk to Crown to say, here's the story of what happened, and now I'm going to tell you about how this victim feels about safety. What are the risk issues? So it immediately changes the response and the attention to how do we keep that question. I said, is she safe? Because we're talking about it right from the very get-go. And it's not a checkbox. It's a narrative. It's language that if you would read it as a service provider, you would see, okay, Richard, I see what you've taken from her. I understand the words, and I can. It's not just a checkbox saying, well, firearms. Like, what does that mean? Like, he has an uncle that has a series of firearms that are locked away, but he's good friends with the uncle. I don't know if he can get it. Is that good information to know rather than a checkbox? Absolutely. And allows us to understand how she might be at risk. Results. So this is kind of cool. If you see the Langley pilot, it's only 6 months, and really it was only 100 cases that we looked at, so small sample size. But the second column is a six-year branch average. So you see under guilty pleas, we went up to 70, or conviction, 70%, while the branch average was 49%. So that represented a 43% increase. Under peace bonds, it dropped. Now, peace bonds, in many instances, what we found with peace bonds, my previous research, is peace bonds was a saw-off. Victim recants, we're going to get nothing, go to defense, will you agree to a peace bond just because I have nothing? So what we found is that peace bond rate dropped because it was changed. We had a much stronger case. Stay of proceedings dropped by 38%. And for me, the most compelling thing is, and I'm mostly going from literature because it's not something that's normally captured. In most of the literature, the recant rate is about 30%. We dropped that down to 6%. So to me, like, we are responding to the needs of the victim. And certainly I'll add, if I have time still, on the domestic violence treatment option, because something that they did, they were when I looked at the review of them, I could see their focus on the offender, but some of the when I saw what their report were, their outcome reports, I saw that the victims were disengaging. They were no longer participating in the feedback as to what happened. And they also had high recant rate. So to me, I'm going, okay, so you're dealing with the offender, you're treating the offender, yet victims are still recanting and victims are not giving you the feedback. So to me, that was a huge flag. And so for me, I thought, like, flip it. It's about the victim. It's not about the offender. But just sort of my perspective on things. So academic hat back on. After I did this, I said, well, I did a research paper evaluating domestic violence programs, and I looked at domestic violence courts, I looked at domestic violence units, and a whole litany of things. What I found a lot of times in the courts, they have very excellent people, high-priced help, understood all the dynamics, and then they would say, but we're still getting recanting victims, and we have lousy police investigations. Because really, it doesn't matter how good those people are. If the police aren't doing their job and the victim feels unsafe, you're going to have a lot of high-priced help not being able to get anything done. Same with domestic violence units. Now, what I'm seeing from what has been discussed here, and I'll talk about the principles, I think a lot of the successes aren't really based on what they're doing, but they're adhering to certain principles. So for me, what I saw, everybody says that keeping women and children safe is a purpose. Every initiative seems to be that's consistent across the board. But in my view, to have a successful intervention with domestic violence, the key goal should be reducing the number of recanting victims, because then it becomes about the victim, because that's the only way she can vote. Because she votes almost, if she votes recant, she's voting, I'm not in, I'm out. So these are the kind of key objectives for any, whatever the intervention is, whether it's a domestic violence court, whether it's a domestic violence unit, whether it's what we did in Langley, you have to have a thorough investigation. Because it's like that adage, garbage in, garbage out, that's exactly it. If it's poor data from the police, you've got nothing. Strong victim advocacy and support is critical, because these are the most vulnerable, confused people in the world. Like, their world is turned upside down, and without it, and it has to come from multiple service providers. Like, it is extremely important. Crown has to have specialization. In other words, they have to get it. I know that is not a very technical word, but they have to really be on top of the dynamics, and they have to have early contact with the victim, and they have to be interested in receiving information from the victim about bail issues and sentencing issues. Because a lot of times, if they're saying it's got to be a severe penalty, victims opt out. A lot of the research says they may not be about punishment. And if you go to absolutes, it's not going to work. I know it's almost counterintuitive, the criminal justice system, and the to end up saying deal with this person because they say it's a crime against society, but this is an act of intimacy, this violence, and you have to listen to the victim. And the final issue was fast-tracking the court through the system. You can't let it, the longer you end up letting it trundle along, the higher the probability you lose a victim.